The Film Guide with Howard Linsky, part of the St. Albans podcast with Danny Smith.
Welcome to another edition of the St. Albans Film Guide with your friend and mine, highly acclaimed local author of note, Howard Linsky.
Hello, mate. How are you doing?
Hello. Yeah, so we are here to do another film show. What we do each time is we look at, in this instance, Howard's choice of films on free-to-air TV for the forthcoming week. We'll also look at a film that Howard has deemed too good to be forgotten. And we will first, though, take a look at new releases on streaming services and in the cinemas. So, Howard, where are we starting this time?
We're going to kick off with A Joyride, which I must admit I only heard about recently. I thought, when I heard the plot of this one, I thought, oh, it sounds like some sort of worthy Korean or Chinese movie, because it was talking about an American Asian character who goes back to the origins of the person's family, in this case China. And it turned out to be a fairly mainstream American comedy. And I watched the trailer and it looks absolutely hilarious. It's directed by Adele Lim in her directorial debut. The film itself stars Ashley Park, Sherry Kohler, Stephanie Tsu and Audrey Sullivan. And the main character is an adoptee with white parents who lives in Seattle and grows up with her childhood best friend. She is an overachiever, the main character. Works as a lawyer at a prestigious law firm and is promised a partnership if she can close a deal with a big Chinese businessman. So she goes to China, her mate tags along. When she gets there, she's told by said big businessman that he won't deal with her properly in terms of a business deal unless he finds out about her family, her roots. God knows why he says this, but, you know, if you can swallow that bit... The ensuing antics look well worth checking out, because I was chuckling along to the trailer. Lots of drug-induced bad decisions, slapstick, slightly gross-out stuff, but funny. It looked like a good one, and I checked out the reviews. The reviews are really positive. So, yeah, it's called Joyride, and well worth checking out, I think.
Okay. That's a film that is out on the 4th of August, as is... The next one we're talking about now, this is kind of the biggie, but not necessarily the better one.
No, I mean
I saw the first. This is a sequel. I saw the first one.
Did you? What did you think of it?
It was a load of old rubbish. Ah. But it was strangely enjoyable.
Well, this might rubbish. Be strangely enjoyable load of old rubbish too. Then,
yes,
it does seem a little bit like it. So I've never seen the first one, mainly because this kind of movie isn't my cup of tea. It's classed as a sci-fi action film, directed by Ben Wheatley. It's based on a novel back from 1999 called The Trench by Steve Alton. As you rightly pointed out, it's the sequel to The Meg, so this one's called Meg 2 The Trench. The previous one was 2018, so they've been polishing the script for 5 years, making it perfect. And then they're casting...
I think you slightly misheard that. I don't think it was polishing, they were saying.
Rattling it out.
Pile of.
Jason Statham, so it must be Oscar worthy if he's in it. Bless him, he's good at what he does, but you know, you kind of know what to expect.
Yes.
He'll be gruff and tough and hard.
He's
and,
very good at that one trick, isn't he?
I think so. He's a movie star rather than an actor, in my opinion, but don't tell him I said that, because he's tougher than me, clearly. He plays Jonas Taylor.
Well, we don't know that, do we? We don't know that.
Well, I know I'm not very tough.
Statham, out in the car park now. You and
Linsky. I'm guessing Statham's not too bad at the old... fisticuffs.
Let's call him out now. If he doesn't turn up, clearly you're the tougher one.
Am I allowed weapons? You know, some description. Probably a gun.
You don't need them. You've got your wits.
No. Yes. If
he doesn't turn up, now we've thrown down that challenge.
Well,
you're the winner.
That's true. Yeah. Officially. If he's not here within the next couple of hours, shall we give him?
Yeah. If you can take on a middle-aged bloke from Welland Garden City, Statham, you know.
Yeah. God, now you must be quaking.
Yeah.
Dear me. Although I'm only technically middle-aged in the sense that people don't normally live to be twice my age, but I get what you're saying. You know, thanks for that.
Anyway, advancing middle age.
We move off on a tangent as usual. But
all right. So when he's not fighting, you know, local authors of notes, then he's off fighting megalodons,
malevolent mining operations, and basically Uber sharks. So it's like a kind of. The Meg is kind of like a prehistoric shark.
Yes.
That has been released, hasn't
Weirdly,
it? You maybe remember from the first film.
It's in the story, it's in the news, on the day of recording, that a boy has found a megalodon tooth.
Well, tell him to put it back, because clearly he's going to release demon or something.
Worse yet, he found it on the coast in Essex somewhere.
Oh my.
He was on holiday. The boy's from Hemel, and it's right. in the local news at the moment that he found this megalodon tooth.
I did see the headline this morning. It said he was over the moon because he'd found a megalodon tooth. Yeah. So yeah, he might not be so chirpy if the megalodon comes looking for its tooth.
No.
And do you think, you know, Essex, is that where Statham's from originally? He's got that kind of accent.
I think so.
London-y accent. Oh, you, oh, it's you coming for him.
You're suspicious. Or maybe suspicious of the film producers planting this somewhere.
I was thinking more like, you know, let's get really out there, and the conspiracy theory is that the megalodon's looking for him.
Yeah.
Having killed its relatives, you know. So, yeah.
So as I understand it from my megalodon research, these are sort of prehistoric dinosaur-type sharks, but they existed long after the dinosaurs were extinct. The dinosaurs went extinct around about 65 million years ago. These are believed to have been in our waters around about 20 million years ago.
Right.
And they are depicted as being massive great white sharks.
Yeah.
Except that, and they could probably swallow a great white shark almost whole.
I think that was the implication from the trailer that I saw, which is obviously a documentary.
Yeah. So the article that I read off of a news website, so possibly slightly more reliable, was basically saying scientists have no idea what they look like.
Oh.
They are assuming they might look a bit like a great white shark, but they know the size of them. So they know, and they know from the teeth in particular, they know what the size of the jaws would be like, which in turn means that they're quite confident on the size of the thing.
Right.
So it could comfortably swallow
a
great white
shark. Like a shark, they don't know. It could be like a whale or.
Well, so there's enough about it that puts it in the shark family.
Right.
But they all the images of megalodons in books and things, they've just made up. But they've based it on like an amalgam of several types of shark and put it together.
So it's basically Jaws meets Jurassic Park, isn't
kind
it?
Kind of,
what this is.
Yeah.
But not
Jurassic Jaws, which is probably already a title of a film that's gone direct
More
to streaming
likely.
Somewhere.
More than likely. But yes, so you know what you're getting. And if you watch the trailer, you'll see it's, you know, people get eaten. Some of the people don't get eaten, at least at the beginning. And they've got to kind of outwit the shark and also the mining operation people. There's nearly always a corporation or a bad company that kind of goes, hey, we don't care about the consequences, we're just going to make money, and they've released a threat, and in this case it's a megalodon and his mates, presumably.
Well, so in the first one they went and drilled or something, they went below the Mariana Trench, which is the lowest part of the ocean,
the deepest,
it turned out that underneath the trench is where there were megalodons still living.
Right.
And then by coming up through the trench, by humans meddling.
A bit like releasing a demon through a portal.
Corporations doing it for profit over what was best for the world.
Right.
In coming back up, they created a tunnel that these... And the big twist, the first movie, The Meg, I'm going to ruin this for you slightly.
There were
two of them.
Ah.
And when Statham caught one... He didn't realise that its mother was out there, because it wasn't just the one that followed through it, like, and broke through the barrier of the trench.
It was the sequel that broke through.
Well, no. So by the end of the movie, because like you're midway through, and they've kind of caught one.
Yeah.
And they you have this massive thing there, and it's kind of lying across the back of a huge tanker of some description.
Oh, right.
And then suddenly another one jumps out of the water that makes that first one dwarfed in size. You know, it's suddenly like the other one's even bigger.
Wow.
And then he realizes that he's gone and pissed off his mother.
You might think that if you've released a prehistoric megalodon that's been prowling around for years, your second thought after killing it might be, God, I really hope there aren't any more out there. And
By the end of the movie, he then managed to do in the second one as well. And then that's the end of that. But I believe I saw a trailer for the Meg 2. And there is one point where there are suddenly three fins that appear in the water chasing people down. So,
well, what's scarier than one and scarier than two?
Ask
yourself that question. Three. Yeah. Clearly, they decided they'd write the script about three.
But it amazes me that these were based on this is based on, I believe, a series of novels. I believe it's the Trench series of novels.
Yeah,
which makes it sound like these are sort of great tomes of literature. I suspect they're not.
Or just they sell very well for whatever reason.
Well, maybe not even that. Mm. And maybe they just, you know, some sort of, you know, crappy sci-fi-esque story.
I'm in the wrong game. I should be writing crappy sci-fi.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe that's the thing. I mean, it's sometimes you look at adaptations and the actual original source material, you sort of think, that wasn't actually that good. You know, especially when it's based on a book that you've never heard of.
Or it's just very different. I mean, the big children's one is that How to Train Your Dragon, which is a huge franchise. that obviously I was familiar with, having had a young daughter years ago. And I bought the book and it was nothing like it. And I thought, blimey, you know, you've taken the title and the concept and paid the author over and over again for something that doesn't really resemble the books at all. And I think that happens quite often. I mean, the Bourne books are very different to the whole film thing. But we digress again. I could bring up about Bourne and how different it is for ages, and I won't bore our listeners. I won't bore with Bourne.
No, okay. So, so just for those who are still listening, this film, The Meg 2, is based on the second book. So they're being faithful in that sense.
Gosh, how many of them are? How many can we look forward to?
I'm trying to look this up now.
127 of them?
Yeah, so this was the book which was originally... the book was originally called The Trench.
Right.
Which now has been reprinted as The Trench, Meg 2. and it's the sequel to the novel Meg. And it just says here it's the second of the Meg series. And then there's a third one. So there's a trilogy.
There's at least three then.
Yeah. Meg, Primal Waters.
The author's frantically writing book four as we speak.
Yeah.
Probably, just in case.
Yeah. And yeah, it's... Oh dear.
Anyway, if you like that kind of thing...
Came out in 2004, the third one. So it's nearly 20 years since the third book came out. So with any luck, the guy's given up trying to write them. But you never know, do you?
Yeah, I suspect he's dusting off the laptop and getting stuck in. Well, you would, wouldn't you?
Yeah. No, I'm making that up. Something he's written other books featuring, it would seem, this character.
Oh,
yeah.
Which one? The person or the shark?
The character that Statham's playing, right. Jonas Brother or whatever he's called.
Jonas Taylor.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There are 7 books in the series. The most recent one written this year.
This could be like Mission Impossible. It could take years to go through them.
The Trench.
Right.
There's Meg, Primal Waters. So originally there was The Meg, and then The Trench, Meg Primal Waters, Meg Hell's Aquarium. You should write this down. Meg Origins,
right?
Meg Night Stalkers, Meg Generations. They've ripping off Star Trek. And then Meg Purgatory was the one that came out this year.
Oh well, we're stuck in Meg Purgatory.
Yeah. Dearing me.
Well, I've not seen the first. I don't think I bothered with the sequel.
But no.
If it's your kind, if you like a Jawsy type thing where, the villains and some of the good guys get gobbled up by even bigger sharks.
On a total tangent, which is not unlike us when we do this.
No, it's not unlike us.
So I read the other day about the book First Blood that was turned into the first Rambo movie. The author of it wrote the book and apparently was quite a serious writer, and it wasn't really his intention for it to cash in on the commercialism of it. It was adapted
quite
and it was
Vietnam
made as a
war veteran story, wasn't it?
And the first one was made as quite a worthy movie.
It was,
And at the end of the book, Rambo dies. He gets killed in the shootout at the end, whereas in the movie he survives and of course spawns several sequels. The guy who wrote it was then offered a sum of money to novelise the sequel. Which he then gladly did. Right. And so, the second book he brought out completely contradicts the ending of the first one.
Ignores the ending.
He doesn't even try to rewrite it or try to sort of retcon it or say,
he doesn't say we brought him back to life. Or
even that he didn't die from his wounds or that they, no. He just ignores it and carries on. Would you sell out like that if it was one of your books?
Absolutely. The money with... right now.
Well, there you go.
How much did he get? I'm
trying to set up a Howard Linsky's a man of integrity, and it turns out he left his integrity at home.
Exactly. Artistic merit? Forget it, mate. I'm into dollars these days.
Yeah. There you go. But Steve Allen is the author...
If anybody wants to change any of my endings, you go for it. Sorry, mate. Steve Allen.
Steve Allen's the author of the Meg series, so that's someone to look out for in the bookshops.
Good for Steve. Well done, mate.
Yeah. I haven't got his name wrong. Alton. Steve Alton.
Yes, that's what I put in my notes.
Yeah, sorry, Steve I misread Alton. That. Yeah, Steve Alton. He's at the A's. You look a little bit further along to the L's, and that's where Howard is.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm sure you're on the same shelves.
If anyone out there from Hollywood is listening to our film podcasts, I'm sure they all do.
Yeah.
Then, if you want to novelise my books, they're available now. So, yeah. Brad Pitt, if you're listening, and you want to play David Blake...
Yeah.
Give us a call.
If it's a movie of your life, you're more likely to get Brad's cousin, aren't you, Sess?
I'd get Booze Cruise rather than Tom Cruise, wouldn't I?
Hi, I'm Elspeth Jackman, inviting you to listen to my podcast One to One with Elspeth. find a local person with a story, and I'll be there to draw out all those little details you want to know about. If I'm fascinated, so will you be. Each week I'll be talking to an interesting character who has a tale to tell. And the beauty of it is you can listen whenever you want to. To find the podcast, go to your podcasting platform of choice and search for the St. Albans Podcast. Alternatively, go to stalbanspodcast.com/Elspeth. That's one-to-one with Elspeth, part of the St. Albans Podcast in association with the Hearts Advertiser. You never know, you could be my next guest.
One new release on a streaming platform. It's on Prime Movies, out August the 4th. It is Kandahar.
Yes,
tell us more.
Kandahar, an American action film directed by Rick Roman. Is he the war or waff? I mean, I've had people.
Wow.
Could be wow. W-A-U-G-H, anyway. You can pronounce
Probably war. So it's a war movie directed by a war.
Yeah. But I did go to school with a guy who spelled his name like that, and he was called Waff. But hey, what do you do?
Yeah, you went to a posh school there, didn't you?
Well, not really, mate. As you can probably gather, it was the opposite. That's probably why he called himself Waff and not war. Not like evil in war.
I was going to say, his name's spelled the same way, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, I digress. Again, it's got Gerard Butler. He stars in it. Don't know if he had to audition too hard for this one, because he's also the producer.
He decided
he was a great actor and gave him the lead role. He plays Tom Harris, who is a freelance undercover operative working for the CIA, like you do. And he sabotages an Iranian nuclear research facility by sticking, malware? How do you pronounce that again?
Malware.
There you go. He sticks that in it. Thank you for helping me out with that one. And the facility self-destructs, like it does when you stick that stuff in it. But due to an intelligence leak, his name and his cover is blown. So the rest of the movie is him and his Afghan-American translator, Mo, heading for an extraction point in Kandahar, hotly pursued by the baddies, who in this case are the Iranian and Pakistani security services. So it is a sort of shoot 'em up kind of Gerard Butler style movie, I guess.
For those who are interested, the director has worked with Mr. Butler before. Angel Has Fallen was one of Rick, whatever we're calling him, Roland.
It's probably War.
Rowling.
It's only Woffy like. If you live where I'm from, so, you know. All right, Woffy. Yeah.
And he did, what else did he do here that people might have heard of? Oh, he did a film more recently called Greenland, which was also with Gerard Butler. And Snitch he did, which was the one with The Rock, where The Rock wasn't playing a big tough guy.
Oh.
In fact, there's a bit where The Rock gets beaten up by a couple of big tough guys.
Wow.
Greenland was... I'm sure we've talked about this movie. Something about a natural disaster and Gerard Butler trying to get his family out of there.
Yes, I think that's streaming at the moment, isn't it? Like, I probably saved it to watch, but I haven't got around to it yet.
I was very intrigued when I looked at the guy's the directorial credits, the first movie that he did. There's an image of it, and I in fact, Howard, just take your headphones off for a second, come around here,
okay, I'll
and just
do
have
that.
A look at this image,
this,
and then,
you can
and
tell
then
you this can, is live
and then you can get, run straight back round and tell the listener how good you think the movie is just based on the image for the artwork, because that's the artwork.
Yeah, it's clearly a tasteful, historical documentary?
Yeah, yeah. They're
scantily clad young lady.
Yeah, they're clearly, very confident that the rest of the movie's good, that's how they're going to sell
it. Yes,
it's basically, the cover is a cleavage.
It is.
Yes, it's basically a cleavage. But that's his first movie, which went straight to video, apparently, that one.
Oh.
Weirdly. But since then, he had done Angel Has Fallen, which was quite a big movie. Snitch.
It was.
Snitch was a reasonably big film, from what I remember at the time. And it was, it was about, The Rock played a father, and his son was, in order for his son to not go to prison, the father agreed to go undercover for the DEA or someone.
Oh, right.
And they said that if he does a certain thing, then they'll let him out again. It was, The Rock and Susan Sarandon was in the movie as well. In the movie, The Rock was just a regular Joe, and there's one bit where he gets beaten up by a couple of thugs, and you're just thinking, in any of his other movies, he'd have eaten them for breakfast.
You're waiting for the bit where he suddenly growls and beats them up. And, absorbs a few punches, but then kicks them all over the room.
Yeah. Carves them a new one, as I believe they say.
Yes.
Anyway, the film... the fact that we've barely talked about the film in question might tell you something about it as well.
Yeah, I mean,
but you never know. But if it's an original movie going straight to Prime Video, I kind of equate a lot of those these days with the old direct-to-DVD.
Yes, we talked about that. I do take your point and sort of agree with you to an extent, but some of them do appear to have been the beneficiary of huge money from Prime Video or Netflix or whoever. So they do their own original material, don't they?
Oh, yeah, they do. And I guess there are varying degrees of quality. But I'm starting to get a sense now that you can spot the good ones from the less good ones.
Right there.
When Martin Scorsese is directing one and it's straight to Netflix, you sort of think, yeah, we're going to hear about this film again when the Oscars come around, you know. And
that's
and
true.
When it's got certain actors in it, you think, yeah, this is actually going to be pretty massive.
If there's an Oscar for stunts, you know, then maybe, but I don't think it's going to trouble any of you. I don't think the screenplay or the acting is going to trouble anyone at the Oscars, and it's not an Academy Award winner.
No.
But it's a Saturday night movie, you know, it's one of those.
Yeah,
it might be all right.
I guess, really, you know what you're getting going into it, you know, and it's an action film. It's about what? Some sort of special ops type bloke.
Yes.
Gerard Butler's in it. Yeah. You know what you're going to get.
Exactly.
And if you know that, your expectancy set at a certain level, and I suspect it will tick all those boxes most adequately. It will have quite good, believable effects. But so some of these movies, there was one earlier in the year. No, it was last year, called Without Remorse, which was Michael B. Jordan. And this was an Amazon...
Oh, yes. Yes, I haven't seen that one, but I know the one you mean.
This was a Prime Video exclusive original movie, and it was going to be the start of a big franchise and all of that. And it was awful.
Really, that
and it was
bad.
Atrocious. Yeah. And what one of the things that was really bad was that Michael B. Jordan is a relatively kind of the critical Creed. And commercial
yes,
star.
Yes, Creed himself.
Yeah. He's got a good pedigree now. He produces and directs as well as stars in his movies. Mm. And the source material was by Tom Clancy. And at the time, Amazon had got some sort of deal with Tom Clancy's estate. And so they've made the Jack Ryan series, which has been hugely successful with John Krasinski in it. And
that's a character that keeps on giving for years and years and years now. Ever since for Red October was a movie in the 80s.
Exactly, you know, Alec Baldwin and Harrison Ford and Ben Affleck and Chris Pine have all played this guy
that's
as well.
Right. Yeah.
And Amazon Prime own the rights to it all.
Right.
And Without Remorse, the book was set within the universe of Jack Ryan. And so you're thinking, oh, wow, they're developing a new franchise. Then they'll bring them together in some way. And the film just bombed.
Did it? Oh,
did not do very well at all. So, you know, sometimes money, it's not all of it.
Quality. Yeah.
No. But anyway, Kandahar comes out on the 4th of August on Prime Video.
The Film Guide with Howard Linsky, part of the St. Albans podcast with Danny Smith.
We reach the point in the show when Howard Linsky is with us, who is, by the way, highly acclaimed local author of note. I forgot that bit at the beginning.
I think we agreed on Much Loved as well, didn't we?
I think you know what? There's a line. There's a line, Howard. And that's where you crossed it.
Oh,
my friend.
Damn it. Okay.
I do not think I could.
I'm clearly not paying you enough to be much loved.
I could not say in good conscience that there is anything about you that is much loved.
All right. Well, slightly respected then, whatever.
Unless the words he's never been precede that.
Okay. He's never been much loved, but he's slightly respected by one or two readers.
Yeah.
That'll do.
But anyway, this part of the film guide when Howard hosts is known as
Too Good to Be Forgotten.
We did no rehearsal. I just pointed and you did it.
And I even did the echo myself without a sound effect.
That bit may not be true. But there you go. No run up. No having to edit that and do it more than once.
Not at all.
I hope you're paying attention, Max Hartington. Anyway, Too Good to Be Forgotten this month. Tell us about the movie that you deem too good to be forgotten.
Yeah, okay. This one's from 1999 and it is called October Sky. And luckily, it's currently on Netflix as well. So if you've got Netflix, you could check it out. I always start with this, but do you know it? Have you seen it, Donny? Because you've seen lots of movies.
Do you know what? Not only have I not seen it, I'm not aware of it.
And I sympathise.
Which you take as a big sort of like, that's a big win for you, isn't it?
I look upon it as then it is too good to be forgotten. You know,
because
you
it has
seen
been
it. And also, I am with you because I didn't know about it either. So I found this by doing what I tend to do kind of late at night, which is looking for decent movies, discarding 99 out of 100 of them, and occasionally going, oh, this looks okay. And so I don't just watch the trailer, I'll check the, you know, Wikipedia entry, and I'll read some reviews. Now, I thought, this looks pretty interesting. Now, what I liked about it was it's based on a true story. So, and the cast is really good. Going back to 1999, you've got a young Jake Gyllenhaal in the lead role. He's supported by Chris Cooper, who is you know, I've been a fan of ever since Lone Star, which is another one that we talked about as Too Good to Be Forgotten before. Chris Owens in it, who you'll recognise from things like American Pie, and Laura Dern, who's always very good. She plays the school teacher in the school that Jake Gyllenhaal's character goes to. Now, the story is about a coal miner's son in 1957 in a sort of rough and deprived area of West Virginia. And he's inspired by the launch of Sputnik 1, the Russian first satellite to go up into space. And he takes up rocketry, as it's known, against his father's wishes, very much against his father's wishes. And that becomes his hobby. So instead of just, like everybody else in his school, going, yeah, I'll just become a miner like my dad, he doesn't want to do that. So he starts building and launching rockets with his friends. And these things get bigger and bigger, and eventually they become pretty damn big and they fly off great heights. But obviously he's up against the obstacles of his dad, his whole town, really. You're like, what on earth are you doing at first? And it's a true story about a guy called Homer H. Hickam, who, despite all the life that I've just described that he went through, he kept up with this. And he eventually managed to get a scholarship to high school. He, in real life, diverted off to the Vietnam War, where he served as a lieutenant and then a captain. But then when he returned, he became a NASA engineer, for real. And with his background, that was incredible. And it's a pretty much a sort of, a kind of feel-good story, but there is serious stuff. His teacher gets cancer, and that happened in real life. It is a bit schmaltzy toward the end, but then it redeems itself with 10 minutes to go. And I said, the fact, if you'd made this up, I would dismiss it. But the fact that it was a true story, the guy ends up in the organisation overseeing NASA as an older man.
So one of the things I love about movies that are based on true people and true events is when at the end, and I always feel this adds a degree of authenticity, when they, in the end credit roll, show you the real people.
And that is exactly what they do, yes. I agree with you totally, because it makes it feel real.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've got even video footage of the kids.
Yeah. So that's always great. I try, because I know nothing of the movie, I try to find something interesting I can share with you that you might like. So apparently the author of which the book that was written that this is based on, the author of that book didn't want it to be called this, because
I think it's him, isn't it? It's Homer H. Hickam who wrote the book.
Right. But the book,
it's his memoir.
Okay. But the book was originally, the book that it is based on is called Rocket Boys.
Yes, that's correct.
And he, and yet the studio wouldn't let it be called that. They said that won't work as a title, and they came up with October Sky, which he was quite happy about, because October is the month when Sputnik flew overhead, yep. and so that works with it. But also, apparently, October Sky is an anagram of Rocket Boys.
Oh,
so
yes.
The author thought, yes. That'll do. I'm all right with that.
Very good, yeah. There is another good one. So I was quite fascinated by the guy. So I researched to see how much of it was true and all that. Anyway, there's a great little story from when he was quite an old man, and not that long ago, and he was on Twitter, and he noticed that a girl had been given a scholarship to NASA, or an internship at NASA, sorry. And she tweeted, and you know, in her euphoria, she used, you know, fruity language. And it was one of those, I got a thing at NASA, hurrah. And he just put underneath language, and she swore at him again and went, who the hell are you, kind of thing. I'm going to NASA. And he said, yeah, I'm on the committee that oversees NASA. Now, NASA spotted her swearing, and not only that, all her friends piled in on him. And he kind of just withdrew from it. He didn't get involved anymore. But NASA cancelled her internship. They kind of fired her.
Wow.
Because of the foul-mouthing and insulting him and all these kids wading in. And I thought, oh, God, I hope he wasn't behind that. So I read some more. And he wasn't behind it. And not only that, he said, nothing to do with me, and I'm going to do my best to make sure she gets an even better internship somewhere else.
Oh, okay.
So she apologised to him. He apologised to her because he said, I didn't mean it to escalate. And he blamed her friends for just piling in. And ruining her career.
That's,
you know,
a lovely story. And a great sort of thing there about, you know, be careful what you put on social media.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Because, you know, that whole who are you sort of thing. And he kind of says, I'm your boss. Yes. I'm your future boss.
I'm the guy who oversees your boss.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Been, at that point, he'd been recruited politically to be part of the overseeing organisation of NASA. But yeah, he trained astronauts. And it's well worth a watch. Isn't it? A bit schmaltzy a little bit. And Jake Gyllenhaal's dad, played by Chris Cooper, They've overdone it a bit on what an augury was. Mm. I don't think he would have been like that in real life.
This is the second film in recent months that you've picked with Chris Cooper in it as Your Too Good to Be Forgotten. Yes. Are you a fan of his?
I am. I didn't know he was in it, to be honest.
Right.
Jake Gyllenhaal gets the the poster, as it were, on Netflix. I think it was on when I saw it. And I like Laura Dern as well, but I didn't know she was in it either. But yeah, I think Chris Cooper's very good. He plays a certain kind of slightly whipped character rather well.
Yeah.
You know, he's a good actor. And I think he went on and won an Oscar, didn't he, for something? So
yeah, I believe you're right.
So,
I'm trying to think. And he, of course, he was in the Bourne films as well, wasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, he's in the Bourne films.
He's very good in those. And he was in a Muppet movie.
Ah, I might have missed that one.
What?
Yeah, sorry.
I'm trying to find out now about his award winning, because I'm sure he has won something.
Lone Star was definitely the movie that launched him, in my opinion, unless there was something else out there around about the same time. But I remember seeing him in that and thinking, this guy's good.
Yeah. No, he did indeed win an Oscar. And of course, this is the moment now that my computer's going to be slow, isn't it? So I'm...
This is where we stop blagging that you're just trying to remember in that encyclopedia brain of yours.
No, I can tell you that he won an Oscar for Adaptation. He was Best Supporting Actor in Adaptation. That was the thing with Nicolas Cage, wasn't it?
Yes, I think so. And I don't really like the stuff that the guy writes who did Adaptation. He did the John Malkovich thing as well.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
And Eternal Sunshine, I quite like that, but he's a bit weird.
Yeah.
The stuff's a bit weird
for me. It's the thing about Charlie Kaufman, isn't it?
Yeah, he's a bit surreal.
Yeah. Anyway, there you go. Chris Cooper then, someone that perhaps you didn't quite appreciate how much you appreciated him.
Yes, I spotted his potential very early, but I didn't realise quite so many, all the movies that he's been in, but he's very, very good. So check him out. Oh, he's also in American Beauty, isn't he?
Right, okay.
I think he plays the repressed dad in that, unless I got that wrong.
We can mention that film again now, can't we?
Are we allowed to? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah,
now that certain people have been acquitted.
Yeah, yeah. There you go.
Yes. Hmm.
Hi, I'm Matt Adams, the heart of the Hearts Advertiser for over 10 years. Join me and host Danny Smith for St Albans Podcast, a weekly look at the news, views and reviews of the city and district of St Albans. As well as our delve into the local stories that matter, we regularly cover topics including health, food and drink, legal matters, the theatre scene and mental health. Alongside our regular features, we talk to people from our wonderful community, sharing some of the amazing work they do. Episodes are released every Wednesday at 7 p.m. and you can find us by going to your podcast platform of choice and searching for the St Albans Podcast. Find out more at stalbanspodcast.com.
Let's take a look now at Harold Linsky's choices of films on free-to-air TV for the forthcoming week. We start with Friday the 4th of August, very late tonight, technically into tomorrow morning, 12:55 a.m. Film 4, we have Animal Kingdom.
Yeah, this is a good one. It's an Aussie crime drama, and I remember seeing it when it came out, so a good while ago now. Written and directed by David Michaud in his feature directorial debut, stars some people you will have heard of: Ben Mendelsohn, Joel Edgerton, and Guy Pearce, all of whom...
Neighbours Guy Pearce.
That's the fella? Yes, he peaked in Neighbours. Whatever happened to him? Did one or two movies after that, you know.
Yeah.
But Neighbours Guy Pearce is what contractually obliged to call him. But all three of those guys gone on to do, you know, pretty amazing things since then. It's amazing to see it acknowledged as such, but it's inspired by a true crime that was committed in 1998, where two police officers were shot in the Walsh Street police shootings, and the crime family, the alleged crime family, or I think they have been... linked with other crimes for a long period of time, that family was accused of the murders and they got off. So this follows a fictional story similar to that, and it involves a 17-year-old boy who's part of that family, and he goes to see his grandmother, who is the matriarch of the family. He needs help because his mum's not with it, and she invites him to move in with her. And of course, in doing so, he then sees what the rest of the family are up to. One of whom commits bank robberies, another is a drug dealer, and one of them is in hiding, and the police are following the whole family around trying to bring them down. So it's a very gritty story about families sticking together but also occasionally splintering apart because they're under pressure from law enforcement, and if people don't testify they could go down for long sentences or they could be killed if they do. So it's good stuff, very well acted, as you can imagine, with that cast. And the lead matriarch in it is very chilling as well.
And I believe she got nominated for an Oscar for that part.
Oh, wow. I didn't realise that. Yeah.
So that's Animal Kingdom. That is Howard's choice for Friday, the 4th of August. As we say, that's 12:55 a.m. So technically into Saturday morning, but it's a Friday film. And that's on Film 4. We move to Saturday, the 5th of July, 7 p.m. on E4. This is a weird thing for me because this is a film I absolutely love. But I've only ever seen it once.
Ah,
and that's weird because normally films I like, I'd have seen a couple of times.
Yeah, it's definitely worth
I've never, look. And I don't know why I've never gone back to watch it again. And I really, now I've seen it here, I'm really thinking, I might try and watch it this week. But Galaxy Quest, 7 p.m. E4, is your pick for Saturday the 5th of July.
It is, and I won't spend forever on it because I know you and I have talked about it at length before. And you said regular listeners, and they're all regular listeners, aren't they?
They both listen regularly.
Well, no, they both listen regularly, yeah. So they've probably heard us say this.
Yeah.
But it's a great film because it's a spoof of Star Trek. It's a parody of that kind of thing.
But it's also a spoof of the culture, isn't it?
Yes,
it's not
it is,
just the
yes.
movie, it's the fandom.
It's like a loving homage, they call them in the movie world, don't they? A homage to that whole world of conventions. And the idea is that this aging cast of a series that's not dissimilar to Star Trek, they're at a convention. Real aliens, if that is even a thing we can talk about, turn up and think, right, we need the crew of Galaxy Quest to save us because they think they're real. And they've been watching the series from space, thinking it's a documentary. So they get the captain, who's a real egotist, and they get him to come out with him. And he thinks he's role-playing.
And he's nothing like Tim Allen there. He's nothing like William Shatner at all.
No way whatsoever.
Absolutely not.
Call off the lawyers.
Yeah.
Call off the lawyers. But anyway, the rest of the cast don't like him. So they're played by Sigourney Weaver and Alan Rickman, who are fabulous. Sam Rockwell's in there as well. There's that acrimony that you associate with the Star Trek cast as well, because they used to fall out all the time.
Yeah, because they rather famously, the most of the supporting cast on the original 60s series are kind of on the record saying that none of them like William Shatner.
Absolutely.
The only ones who really liked him were the other two main stars of Star Trek, you know, Leonard Nimoy and the guy who played the Doctor.
Yeah, exactly. And there is that sort of being stuck in a thing with an identity for decades, as well as some of the Star Trek cast were. They may have done other things, but generally...
Well, Alan Rickman really sort of is playing the Leonard Nimoy-type actor in this, because Leonard Nimoy was rather famous for hating Star Trek at the time, hated the fact that he was doing something so lowbrow, he was an actor of note.
Wrote a book called I'm Not Spock, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, he tried to get so far away from it, and then eventually got to a point in his life where he thought, this is silly.
Yes.
And then he wrote another book, I Am Spock.
Oh, right.
And he completely did a U-turn and embraced it because he thought, this is what's made me.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
This is
what the life he's had. He's had, you know, the fame, the money, and the recognition from fans.
Yeah.
And you're right. Rickman in this is brilliant because he just is grumpy all the time about doing it.
And little Leonard Nimoy fact here, but Leonard Nimoy directed two of the biggest films of the 80s.
Three Men and a Baby.
Three Men and a Baby, which I think was the biggest film of the year it came out.
Yeah.
And I think the year before, the biggest film was Star Trek 4.
Yeah.
He directed both of those. Wow. And, you know, yet he's not known for being a director. He's only known for Spock.
Yep.
But
I think was his entire point.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then he embraced it, as you said.
Yeah.
But this is great fun. It's really funny. It is affectionate as well. And Sigourney Weaver and Alan Rickman's characters are brilliant. I mean, Sigourney Weaver's always running around in his tight-fitting, cleavage-enhancing jumpsuits and mocking the fact she has to do that.
Yeah.
Alan Rickman keeps saying that he got three standing ovations playing Richard III, I think, something like that. And his thing is he has a punchline that he has to keep repeating whenever anybody meets him, and he hates it.
It's a catchphrase. And also he had prosthetics he had to wear.
That's right.
Which, much like Spock with the ears. And
yes.
Yeah. It's, yeah. But
and of course, then what happens is that the plot, it gets trickier because Tim Allen comes back, gets the whole crew together. They then go and do the thing, trying to save these aliens. Watch it again, mate, because I've seen it a couple of times. It's very, very good.
That's Galaxy Quest, 7 p.m. E4, Saturday the 5th of August. So we move to Sunday the 6th of August, 10:30 p.m. on BBC One. Quite a change of pace here. We have The King's Speech.
Yes, The King's Speech. This was a very successful movie back in 2010. It features King George the 6th, who famously had to cope with having a stammer. He had a speech impediment. He stuttered. And he became king in a world where the radio was king. That was becoming a massive thing at the time. Well, it had been for a little while. And he knew that being king, he had to go on and do speeches. And the premise is he's building up to the big speech when war is declared, and he has to go on and reassure the country and the empire, by the way, that we will get through this. And in it's a true story to an extent. Obviously, some liberties were taken. But George VI, who is played by Colin Firth in his Oscar-winning Best Actor role, he teams up with a speech therapist called Lionel Logg, I think it is, played by Geoffrey Rush, and very well played by Geoffrey Rush, I should add. I think he's also had a few awards thrown at him for this one. And there is an initial clash. They become friendly, and they work together, but the speech therapist's techniques are unconventional, and there is a lack of formality in Geoffrey Rush's character, because he's an Aussie, and he's not going to call His Majesty, Your Majesty and Your Highness all the time. But somehow it works together, and it builds up to this point where, under a huge amount of pressure, King George VI, played by Colin Firth, has to make this incredible speech that goes down in history and is well remembered by all who heard it.
Yeah, I mean, it is a wonderful British movie. It won 4 Oscars when it came out. Helena Bonham Carter's very good in it as well.
She's good in it as the wife of George the Sixth. Yes, she's very good.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I seem to remember from the movie was it covers a span, doesn't it? A period of time. And was it that there was basically, you saw in it some children. You saw the king's
kids, I think, yeah.
Two daughters,
yeah,
and you see the speech the guys, the therapist's sons, and one of those sets of children, it was the same actors throughout, and the other one, you saw different people playing them at different ages.
I didn't notice that. I didn't realise.
And I found that slightly disconcerting. Okay. I have a feeling that the king's daughters might have been the same actors.
Ah.
But the speech therapist's sons were different actors as they aged.
It's a while ago, but I don't remember spotting that. So,
and yeah, I partly spotted it because the girl who played Elizabeth, of course, the Queen Elizabeth II as she became, was the young girl actor from Outnumbered.
Oh, yes.
I recognised her and then thought, well, she's in this throughout. Whereas I think at the end of the King's speech, the sons were like men. And when you first see it, they're boys.
She must have had a good agent and they couldn't afford to get anybody else, you know, after.
I mean, it's possible I'm slightly misremembering it, and maybe you didn't see the daughters as often, so you only saw them at certain points where they were approximately the same age, maybe. But yeah, you mentioned about Geoffrey Rush. He was nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor.
I thought he might have been, but I didn't want to put it out there. I thought I was going to say he got some plaudits, but...
It won Best Director, it won Best Picture as well. Mm. And
it was the big movie of that
Helena
year, yeah.
Bonham Carter was nominated for Best Supporting as well.
Right. Rightly so. She's very good.
A great, great movie. It's interesting how you mentioned as well at the beginning that the medium of radio was so important, and to have a king that had speech problems was catastrophic, because in a conversely weird sort of way, the Americans had the opposite problem at the same time, because the American president at the time, Franklin D. Roosevelt, was disabled, was in a wheelchair, and yet because you only really saw the odd picture of a president and you heard them on the radio, it wasn't a problem.
Wasn't
and I've heard
issue,
it,
yeah.
I remember it being debated at the time that the King's speech came out, that they were saying that if it were the age of television, Franklin D.
Yeah.
Roosevelt would probably never have been president, because he didn't look like he should be a president.
Yeah, he didn't look as president.
Whereas the problem...
Back in
the
era with a much more prejudice towards that kind
of
thing as well.
Whereas with the King's speech, you know, the George VI looked regal. He looked the part. He just had a problem with how he sounded.
Yes, and of course he always had
Which probably would also have been a difficulty in the television age as well.
Yeah.
But,
and he wasn't meant to be king originally, because his brother obviously abdicated, so there was that hanging over him as well, you know, which...
Yes, he was never ready to be king. It was never part of his path, was it?
It was never part of the plan.
No.
You know, until he got older.
But yes, and there's a great film that covers a similar period of time about Roosevelt called Hyde Park on the Hudson, and... Bill Murray plays Roosevelt in that movie.
I've heard of that one, but I've not seen that.
It's a British movie, but it's American cast.
Is it too good to be forgotten?
it could be. It's a great. Bill Murray's wonderful in it, and Laura Linney's in it as well.
Oh, I like her. She's good.
Yeah. And yeah, it's very good. But anyway, this is a digression. But that's set in 1936, which I believe is where this movie starts. Anyway,
yes, building up to 39 indeed.
Yeah. So that's the King's Speech, 10:30 p.m. on BBC One, Sunday the 6th of August. We move to Monday the 7th of August, 6:55 p.m. on Film 4. We have My Best Friend's Wedding.
Yeah, I think we might have talked about this a while ago, but it's a comedy. It's from 97, and it has got Julia Roberts in it, alongside Dermot Mulroney, Cameron Diaz and Rupert Everett. For those that don't know the plot, it's triggered by the fact that Julia Roberts and Dermot Mulroney's characters are friends, and they have one of those pacts where they go, you know what, if we're not both married at 28, let's marry, you know, because we get on so well. And then a few days before her 28th birthday, he rings up and says he's met someone. It's Cameron Diaz's character. She's younger than him. He's got a rich father who wants the Chicago White Sox, so he must be pretty damn rich. And he's going to marry her. And belatedly, Julia Roberts convinces herself that this friend of hers is the love of her life. So, as you do, she resolves to completely sabotage his wedding. And that is the premise that kicks off the movie. So she flies to where the wedding is going to be happening in a few days' time. So they're such good friends, he only told her he was marrying this girl with 4 days' notice. Got to stretch the imagination a little bit. But the her endeavours to sabotage this wedding is what makes it funny, and not as cruel as it sounds, because it's just totally a comedy. Julia Roberts is terrific in it. Cameron Diaz is funny. She's very good.
Cameron Diaz is a really good comedy actor, isn't she?
Yes, she
is. She's really good, and often gets overlooked because of her beauty. So
yes,
she was often considered to be very beautiful, and that was that. And she was put into a sort of a category, and people didn't quite appreciate her.
Oh, I think
her
she's terrific.
And
I think Julia Roberts is a good comic actress if she's given the right material. I mean, she's proven out before.
But I don't think that's much in question. I think people think that Julia Roberts is a great, versatile actor. She's done some wonderful performances.
True.
Erin Brockovich was wonderful. You know, she's done loads of things.
Yeah.
But I think there are people like Cameron Diaz who get put into a category because...
You're probably right, because they're classed as...
I only feel passionate about this because I've had the same problem all my life, really.
Obviously.
That
I feel equally passionate about Cameron Diaz. So
people just think that, you know, because I'm pretty...
They think you got this gig because of your looks, didn't they?
Yeah.
I get that all the time, too. It's a curse. We've just got to live with it.
Exactly. We just got to power through it.
Yeah.
Now, I've never seen the movie, but am I right in thinking that Rupert Everett almost steals the show?
Yes, he does a bit. So he is... Her, Julia Roberts' gay friend, but at some point, and I think this is a bit of a trope these days, but I can't remember if it was back then, Julia Roberts pretends Rupert Everett is her boyfriend. He comes to the wedding too in order to try and make the other guy jealous, you know, but he does steal the show a bit, and it kind of launched him in Hollywood for a while. It was the era when he became friends with Madonna, and he was in a few movies, and I think he's more back to what he was before, which is doing good, strong, independent stuff in Britain.
Yeah. Okay,
so,
that's my Best Friend's Wedding, a 90s rom-com with Julia Roberts and co. That's 6:55 p.m. on Film 4, Monday the 7th of August. Let's go to Tuesday the 8th of August, 9 p.m. on Great Movies. We have Girl Interrupted.
Yeah.
I do remember seeing this film. This is quite a thriller, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a sort of disturbing thriller as well. It's a bit, I think, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and you've got that kind of vibe going on. It's based on a true story of a memoir of a woman who was young at the time, and she ended up in a she did not have a suicide attempt. She had some pills washed down with booze and ends up being restrained in an institution. So she's wandering around this place. When I say restrained, she's not tied up, but she's not allowed to just leave it. And what so it's based on a true story. But what kind of elevates it is the cast. So you've got Winona Ryder playing the lead role, supported by obviously younger versions of big stars these days. Angelina Jolie's in it. Brittany Murphy is in it. Elizabeth Moss, Jared Leto, and Vanessa Redgrave and Whoopi Goldberg playing the older characters in that that world. And it follows a very turbulent 18 months that Winona Ryder's character has in that place, and her interactions with the fellow patients, I guess is the right word for them, if they're in this situation, and the staff, and questioning really whether the treatments for any of them is any good, or whether they're trying to teach, I think the phrase from the book was, whether they're trying to cure the mind or the brain, if you see what I mean. So you can keep people compliant with various treatments, including drugs, but not necessarily make them come out any better or feeling any better at the end of it.
And that, interestingly, here directed by James Mangold,
yes,
who did Logan, the wonderful movie with which was sort of ending the X-Men,
Wolverine.
The story of that about Wolverine, Hugh Jackman and Patrick Stewart were great. And at the moment, the Indiana Jones movie that's in the cinemas, right. he's the guy behind that as well.
He's the guy behind the new one.
Yeah. Ah. And he also did, was it Le Mans 66, was it called? The car racing film from a couple of years back with Christian Bale and Matt Damon.
That was really good.
Ford
versus Ferrari.
Was that what it was called here? As well.
There are two titles, and I think Ford versus Ferrari over here, but I might be wrong. But you're right, it is about the Le Mans 66 race, and it's very good.
Yes. Yeah.
Well worth a watch.
It is that film, certainly is the one that I mean. Mm. Not sure on the title, because it had a different title in the UK to the US.
Confusingly.
Yeah. I've got a feeling it would be Le Mans 66 over here, because I suspect the Americans aren't smart enough to know what Le Mans, or they pronounce it. What's this Le Mans?
Yeah.
Anyway.
And is he 66?
Yeah.
Do we really need to see a movie?
I haven't seen the first 65 films, so I can't watch this one.
Yes, I've missed the whole franchise.
Yes. Anyway, Girl Interrupted, a great psychological drama from 1999. Wow, 24 years ago.
Can you believe it?
9 p.m. on Great Movies, Tuesday the 8th of August. We move to Wednesday the 9th of August. And this is a film that I watched because you told me to, and I didn't regret that.
Good.
From 1986 on Talking Pictures TV, Wednesday the 9th of August, we have At an Unknown Time, but I'll look it up when we're talking about
it. My apologies, I forgot to put it in
the Mona Lisa.
Yeah, you see, I just like to leave a little error in there every time I do this, so that it shows I'm not entirely perfect. But yes, while you're frantically looking for the time, Mona Lisa. It's a 1986 British crime drama about an ex-con who comes out of jail and he becomes entangled in the dangerous life of a high-class call girl. The film was written and directed by Neil Jordan with the help of David Leland. And it was produced by Handmade Films. And it stars Bob Hoskins, Kathy Tyson, and Markle Caine. There you go. George, played by Bob, is a low-level working-class gangster. He's released after 7 years in prison, and he goes to look for a job from Michael Caine's character, who is his former boss, but is still head of the crime firm that he worked for. And he gets taken on as the driver and bodyguard for a high-priced prostitute named Simone, who's played by Kathy Tyson, who really sprang to fame in this. This was her first major role. Initially there's a lot of antagonism between them, but they do start to get on. He starts to fall for her, and she asks for his help to find a teenage friend who has disappeared. So she was also working as a prostitute on the streets, and she worries that girl is now being abused by her former pimp, who is a violent man by the name of Anderson. And that is the setup. So there's some very, very good performances in it. Robbie Coltrane plays Bob Hoskins' friend as well.
Yeah. This is, if ever there's a Howard Lynskey film, it'll be this.
Yeah, I guess so.
If it's not a war movie, it'll be this sort of thing. Because, you know, sort of East End, gangland, 80s sort of thing.
Gritty.
It's what I associate with you. Even though you, the East End you would have been writing about would have been the East End of up north somewhere, wouldn't it?
Up north somewhere. Yeah. Newcastle probably. But
this seems to be, you know, you.
Yeah, I mean, I like a gangster film. I like a British crime drama, and I like Bob Hoskins. He's in my favourite British crime drama, which is The Long Good Friday.
If you've seen that film, you'll like this film.
Yes, I think so.
But they are by no means carbon copies. He's not playing the character.
So he's not
from
the
there.
Boss. He's very much a low-level operative. He spends quite a lot of the movie in a state of confusion because he's been away for 7 years anyway. Yeah. And he doesn't really get the idea of a high-class call girl and what she might be into.
And it's not violent in the way the other one is.
There's a little violence, but not much.
Yeah. There's enough in there to for the setting for you to believe that it is. They're set in this sort of rough.
I mean, from memory, there's a shooting, a slashing, and a couple of beatings. But you know,
But compared to the Long Good Friday,
where they're hung upside down on meat hooks.
And you know, sort of like assassinating a load of people at the dog track, wasn't it?
Yes,
and
that's right.
Machine guns and
not the dog track. Stock car racing, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
It's all the same.
That's all the same.
All the same.
Well, we'll get letters if I don't correct you. You know, people will be, dear sir.
Yes.
I enjoy your podcast immensely, but I was
from angry
confounded.
From angry in Marshallswick. Yes. They'll be very,
You don't know the Long Good Friday.
No. Anyway, Mona Lisa from 1986 is on Talking Pictures at 9:05 p.m. on Wednesday, the whatever I said it was, at Wednesday the 9th of August.
Yes.
So 9:05 p.m. on Talking Pictures.
Thank you for the research.
And then finally, Thursday the 10th of August, 10:40 p.m. on BBC One, Elizabeth the Golden Age. Now, this is a sequel to a film from 9 years before, Elizabeth?
Yes, it is. Now, so I don't know if you've seen Elizabeth, but it's excellent, and it's probably the movie that launched Kate Blanchett into the big time. She plays Elizabeth the First. She's brilliant in it, and this is a sequel, which is admittedly less brilliant, but still worth a look. The only caveat being, historically, it's a bit inaccurate, and I normally like movies to be spot on. This famously takes a few liberties, as perhaps Bob Hoskins would say in the previous movie. But it portrays events later on in Elizabeth's reign. The first one shows her as a young woman coming to take the throne, and the opposition she had from various people who didn't want her to be queen. This is a few years down the line, and it's the period coming up to the Armada, the Spanish Armada, where and it's 1585, where King Philip of Spain, head of the most powerful country in the world, sees Protestant England not just as a threat but also as an abomination, you know. And this is historically the backdrop of this is when the Pope told everybody in England that it was fine to assassinate Elizabeth because she was really just, you know, not the done thing. She wasn't Catholic. She wasn't the daughter of a legitimate queen because she's Anne Boleyn's daughter, not Catherine of Aragon. So you can just go ahead and kill her if you like. It's not a problem. And you will be, you know, it's a bit like promising suicide bombers heaven. If they take out people, you know, you'll go to heaven straight away. So that is the backdrop. There's a good performance from Geoffrey Rush reprising his role as the Queen's spymaster from the original. And Clive Owen appears as the dashing Sir Walter Raleigh. Samantha Morton plays Mary Queen of Scots. And it's that era as well where Mary is a rival to the throne.
And am I right in thinking that Sir Walter Raleigh actually played almost no part in the Spanish Armada?
Yeah,
and
it was Drake,
Sir Francis Drake.
Drake barely gets a mention in this, which is one of the historical liberties that I would normally profusely object to, and I do to an extent. But it is a good movie. It's fun.
But and isn't there a bit in it when one of the characters says something about like we're losing too many ships in this battle,
yes,
whereas we didn't lose a single ship?
No. And let's be honest, the Spanish Armada was wrecked, but it was mostly wrecked by the weather. But, you know, it was one of those moments in history where we looked like we were going to be overrun. A bit of a Dunkirk moment, in a sense.
Right.
And when everybody was praying, thinking, oh, my God, what are we going to do? How are we going to defeat all these ships? Storms blew up and, you know, dashed the ships, scattered them. Some were dashed on the rocks, some were sunk in bad weather. So we were, you know, obviously if you believe that God is an Englishman back then you thought we were spared by divine winds or what have you. But yeah, what they actually use is something akin to a sort of Game of Thrones style fire ship. I mean, we did use fire ships, but I don't think that accounted for much of the Spanish fleet. And I don't think Raleigh had much to do with it at all. Francis Drake was the guy who was in there.
Yeah, I gather he was part of her court, but he wasn't really part of this action. And our history certainly records Sir Francis Drake. Not, yes. I know this not least because he was a famous Plymouthian. As
that bowler, by any chance?
Yeah, and there's a big statue of him up there, up on Plymouth Hoe, where the bowling thing is supposed to have took place, where he looked out and saw the sea.
He finished his game, apparently. Whether that's a myth or not, I don't know.
So that's history reputes that that's what he did, but apparently the reality of it may not have been quite as arrogant. It was that the winds were all blowing the wrong way anyway, so he knew that he had a few hours. There was no point setting off for a few hours until the tides had turned and the winds had changed. He had time to finish his game of bowls.
And from memory and master and commander, you need the weather gauge, don't you? You always keep mentioning the weather gauge. And famously, Paul Bettany's character keeps going, "What's that again?" And like me, if you keep explaining it to me, I'll just kind of go, "Yeah, okay, yeah, well, weather gauge, right?"
Yeah.
So yeah, it's probably wasn't as arrogant as all that, but no. But it is, it's a good fun historical story, but my advice would be watch it, enjoy it, and then read the real history. And that's how I got into history, watching historical movies that weren't always accurate.
Okay.
But they are pretty good.
Well, there you go. That's Elizabeth the Golden Age. I sort of remember as well that there was, at the time, because they were saying how it was 9 years since the previous one, and the reason for it being 9 years from the first one to the next one is because they wanted Cate Blanchett to be playing the same character,
right.
But this was so many years on that they were playing her at an older time.
Right,
so
gotcha.
So it was a purposeful decision to leave it several years. And I remember at the time, account, them saying that Kate Blanchett said in interviews that she wanted to play Elizabeth again at a later stage in her life, and so there could be a third film at some point with her, you know, at a far greater age. So who knows? I just looked it up. There's nothing in Kate Blanchett's, like, what's coming up to list that she's playing this part again. But
The 1590s were an interesting period, and you've got all Shakespeare and Marlowe and people like that kicking around. So that'd be good.
Philip Marlowe, that's
the fella. Yes,
Maltese. No, that wasn't even him, was it? Which one was anyway?
He's the big sleep. Philip Marlowe. That's it. Isn't he? Yeah. Dashiell Hammett was the Maltese
Sam Falcon. Spade was Maltese Falcon. Yes. Yeah. Anyway, good old Raymond Chandler.
Gotta love him.
Yeah. So anyway, Elizabeth the Golden Age is Howard's final film choice of the week. Now, normally I can pretty easily predict which film you're going to choose because you always go for a war movie as your film of the week. There isn't a war movie in the list.
No, did you notice that?
And then I just think, oh yeah, but then it'll be a historical one. But there are two historical films in there.
Ah.
At least two, because you could technically argue there are more than two. But there are two that are set in like proper history, which is like The King's Speech and Elizabeth the Golden Age. So I can't call it this week, and now you're going to go and pick Mona Lisa, aren't you?
I was going to go for Mona Lisa. Sorry, and I did think it before you started narrowing it down, and then I thought he'll think I've just picked this to spite him, but of course not. I really like Mona Lisa. I like Bob Hoskins' performance in particular, Kathy Tyson, and I've got to mention why it's called Mona Lisa. The Nat King Cole song plays all the way through it.
Yes, Lisa, it does, doesn't it?
In reference to the enigmatic Simone, I should imagine, played by Kathy Tyson.
Yeah.
So check out Mona Lisa. You will not be sorry.
Okay, there you go. So that's Howard's film of the week. If you want to see the list of films that Howard has just recommended, look in the show description of this here podcast of ours. You'll find the list right there. You can also find it on our website at stalbanspodcast.com. Howard, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And coming up next week will be Chris Aikman doing the film guide, and Howard, you'll be back probably around about the same time next month.
Indeed.
See you then.